This episode of AVXL is recorded on March 14th, 2017. We're going to talk about Sony and Samsung. They got new TVs arriving this week. Get your AV101 on with Bi-Wiring. A little taste of title on the cheap. Great HDTV values. Your burning questions and our burning answers. And so much more.
Testing 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content. No matter what your budget is, we love surround sound. We love Atmos. We love great, big, gorgeous screens, projectors, high-quality headphones,
color,
speakers, stereo,
contrast,
live music,
pixel performance,
video games.
Oh, yeah.
Snack food.
Streaming.
Actually, we're both at that age where we've kind of cut out the snack food. More streaming.
More veggies.
Less snack food. I'm Patty Norton.
Hey, I'm Robert Aaron.
And we're just going to cut straight to the chase. It is a big week. Both of us were absolutely blown away at CES, not just by the sheer volume of new televisions, but Sony's OLED TVs, XBR-A1E. I think both of us, in its easel mode, right, they had a bunch of displays. You know, it's a beautiful 55, 65, 77-inch television, and it has an easel stand.
Yes. So rather than being like, we're going to make it 7 millimeters thick, and we're going to put all the connectivity devices and a pair of speakers in a large box you'll stuff somewhere nearby in a complimentary fashion, right? Sony's like, yeah, it's nice. You've got an ultra-thin cable that some four-year-old's going to rip out of the wall. We're looking at you, Norton. We know how your children are. And instead, they actually made it several inches deep and put, you know, a kickstand on it. So it sits there like a giant kickstand on a tablet in one corner of your elegant loft in downtown Hong Kong, Singapore, New York, San Francisco, L.A., wherever you are, where you've got those 20-foot white painted walls, you know, and the... You know what I mean?
This, like, TV could go anywhere.
It's gorgeous, and you can wall hang it.
The panel itself is, like any OLED, pretty thin. I want to say like maybe a centimeter thick total. But then, yeah, it has that stand mounted on the back that incorporates its sweet audio system in addition to all the inputs and everything else.
This is the crazy one where the speaker essentially vibrates.
The whole surface of the TV is one large speaker. They call it the... acoustic surface.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of neat. On the back of the TV, there are four actuators that drive and physically vibrate the glass of the panel to use it as a speaker, one large speaker. The benefit being the sound comes right out of the screen.
The ultimate center channel.
Where you want it to come from. And it was super effective.
At least for dialogue.
I thought it sounded pretty well overall. Built into that kickstand in the back, though, is, I believe, a 4-inch subwoofer as well. So that, especially if you wall mount that, which that stand allows you to, that would give you some reverberation off the back wall and probably provide I haven't actually seen it in that configuration and listened to it. So I'd be kind of curious to see how that changes. But overall, very impressed with the sound quality. On the picture side, they have a new processor specific for... this year called the X1, and in the OLED will be the X1 Extreme.
Yeah, that's the one that makes me laugh.
And I would say one of the best demonstrations I saw is something called Sony Super Bitmapping 4K HDR Tech. This effectively will help minimize banding artifacts and overly compressed video sources. And I believe this is using an object-based system as well for mapping HDR or turning your SDR into HDR as well. Mm-hmm. But that processor's ability to just clean up a lot of common artifacts people complain about. Somebody this week sent me a picture of their Vizio streaming content over, I think it was Amazon or Netflix or one of the content providers. And they were noticing that or this might have been a live broadcast too, but there was severe banding in a particular scene that had a white wall with a point light at the end of the room. So there was it was a well-contrasted scene, yet it had this large plain surface in a sense, or a very... gradient shaded in a sense, that was just filled with all these banding artifacts. And something like Sony Super Bit Processing or Super Bit Mapping would help eliminate those just common artifacts you see with lots of content out there. So it makes everything look better. And yeah, it's an OLED, so it does perfect black and impressive color representation, and viewing angles are perfect. It's a good solid set. Android TV, it's going to have Google Assistant built in, which I'm finally getting my taste of that now on my mobile device. And it's pretty damn impressive. I actually like it a lot. So having that built into a TV, we'll see if that's really a useful thing. I think it would be. 55, 65, 77, like you mentioned. The 55-inch is $5,000 right now. 65-inch, $6,500. 77-inch to be determined. Currently available for pre-order at all your local peoples and online shops. And it's out there.
We're gonna talk about some delightful sub-$1,000 ACTV options a little bit later in the show, but we should probably talk about Samsung's latest update on the Q9 QLED TV coming next week.
Indubitably.
New metal quantum dots. They've improved the AR coding. And new sub-pixel designs, which are kind of fascinating.
It is. It's not the traditional layout of where the red, the blue, and the green sub-pixels are all aligned across the panel. Mm-hmm. These are staggered in a way that's kind of fascinating and probably helps improve that off-axis viewing that everyone's raving about. Samsung held a launch event today in New York City for this very TV to not only announce the sizes and options and when, and they had a chance actually to introduce one variant of the Q9 panel called the Frame. And this is basically using the TV as art, in a sense, in this case, pictures. So it has something called an art mode, 100 pieces of art, 10 categories, quality-looking stuff in terms of the resolution and how it looks. It's some of the better-looking artwork I've seen on any TV. A lot of TVs, there are other TVs that have done this before. I can think of Sharp did it for a while there and others. I've always been disappointed that they don't include the highest, or at least panel native resolution content for the artwork. It's like, why are you using 1080p source material on a 4K display or something like that? Samsung seems to have gotten all this right. And the cool thing about this particular frame design for the Q9, now this will only be available in a 55 or 65 inch panel size. It has interchangeable bezel colors, so if you don't want to go with the traditional black, you can change it up. But how it presents artwork on the screen actually looks a lot like a frame. The Frame, hence the name. And it just looks compelling with the improvements in off-axis viewing for the new Q9 panels. I'm thinking this would make it something you would actually want to put good art on and look at it. So I'll be curious to see that. Let's see. For the Q7, Q8 TVs, you're going to have 55, 65, and 75-inch panel sizes. Samsung did announce that there will be an 88-inch Q9 coming later this year. 88 inches. The Q8 is actually, I've seen it in retail now, and the 55-inch is currently at about $3,500, 65 at $4,500, and the 75 is to be determined. So,
good to know.
This should be one of the very best LCDs this year, and I'll be really curious to see the light output. I would really like to see side-by-side with an OLED, too. Mm-hmm. Currently, all the demos I'm seeing of these TVs, they're always comparing their product to what they were doing last year, which is, you know, great. However, I want to see it, like, pitted against tech versus tech, OLED versus LCD, or however you want to do it. But I'll be curious to see if that additional light output that you can get with it, something like a Samsung QLED, is something, how useful is that in different room environments? So clearly you would need that maybe for the darkest of rooms, but with a little bit of room lighting, would it help? Would it help make that a superior option over something like an OLED? But given what I've seen from the 2017 OLEDs from LG this year too, they're doing lots of things to help improve how that panel looks in a bright room as well. So I think we're going to have lots of great options. Definitely some probably more affordable in terms of the larger size screens going with LCD over OLED. But, you know, that should be of no surprise. It is still considered a premium display technology at this point, even with so many manufacturers out there now. I even saw Philips drop their new OLED too, probably with an LG panel. And it had its Ambilight system on it. So I'm actually seeing good reviews of it. So I can't
know. It's just, that's just, it's.
It's RGB Ambilight now. So it'll.
It's better.
It gives you the cool light show.
Oh, my goodness.
There's actually some benefits for that we could get into some point.
Oh.
Still.
More questionable in the benefits department in our AV 101 definition of the day or week, I guess the case may be. By wiring.
Dun, 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 dun.
So I found on Craigslist an incredible bargain on a pair of 2CI, a fairly vintage pair of Vandersteen speakers, which are sitting behind Mr. Heron right now.
Oh, my.
And we will not be playing around with those right now because we are going to finish the podcast. Otherwise, there goes the day. You know, these are essentially, there's the thing about these speakers, right, that sets them across all of the Vandersteen line is that they are sort of time and phase coherent. And the idea is that they, instead of having all of the drivers on the front of the box, they stagger the woofer, the mid-range, and the tweeter farther back as it kind of gets higher up, and amongst other things, including they are fundamentally baffle-free designs or very small baffle designs. I don't want to go down the sort of speaker philosophy rat hole.
I have more questions.
But one of the things that's funny about this, which is why I'm sitting here with a heavy-duty wire stripper of the automatic, you know, clicking, ratcheting kind that I so love. And
yes, you do.
A stack of Sewell banana plugs that are relatively inexpensive off of Amazon. It's because these speakers, Mr. Vandersteen would prefer that you bi-wired the speakers, which essentially, instead of running one cable to the speaker and having the crossover internally handling the split of the low-end signal to the woofers and the higher-end signals to the tweeter and the mid-range, what he does is you have two sets of inputs. And actually, my old B&W 601s when I was young and wild and insane, and I used to bi-amplify them. I had one amplifier for the low-end channels and a second amplifier for the high-end channels. In bi-wiring, you run two conductors, one amplifier, and you run two sets of speaker cables, one to those low-end connections, one to the higher frequency drivers. Some people.
So you're driving them with the same signal source?
Same signal, same amp.
Okay.
Different wire.
Gotcha.
From the basically, you know, from the post to the back of the amplifier, you stuff two wires into the post to the back of the amplifier, probably with the help of spade lugs. And then you run those lines into two separate inputs on the back of the speaker. This is one of those things I am curious to play with. I, in my wild and audiophile-istic youth, when I finally tracked down a couple of nice amplifiers for a steal from a local audio shop. That's when I experimented with bi-amplification, right? Two separate amplifiers
right.
for the low and the high end on those B&W 601s. I've never played around with bi-wiring. And one, it's an excuse to get out the cable cutters and you know, my beloved Monoprice
12-gauge
speaker cable.
American wire gauge. Well, it's more copper then going to the speaker or from the amp to the speaker.
Right.
So there's probably a benefit there, especially if you're using maybe not the heaviest cable. I think 12 wire gauge in this case is pretty good for what you're doing. But that's one thing I could see as a potential benefit,
this is,
maybe.
You know, this is the kind of thing where, like,
you hear it, the
stereophile crew lies on one side of it, and people like Peter XL and the Audio Critic sit on the other end of it.
Because my first thought is that you're running the mids and you're running the different speakers with totally different signals. I thought that was what bi-wiring was initially.
No, bi-wiring. Bi-wiring is essentially the same signal.
How would you control that?
Yeah. Well, you don't, right? In theory, it's still done by the crossover.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the you know, bi-amplification probably makes more sense in the sense that you have different amplifiers driving different sections of the speaker.
That I can see.
You know, bi-wiring, a lot of people feel that it is a wonderful opportunity for audio distributors to sell additional lengths of incredibly expensive cabling. You know, since I buy my beloved Monoprice cable by the 100-foot spool.
That's the way to do it.
Yes, 12 AWG oxygen-free pure bare copper speaker wire. Yeah, I think, 100 feet, 12 gauge, that set me back a whopping $28. So, you know, no $10,000 speaker cables for me, but, you know, I can afford an extra $3 a speaker cable just to set the speakers up the way Mr. Vandersteen wants me to. But, electrically, I don't think it makes sense, but
it's hard to go against the recommendation of the manufacturer,
at least
until I know better or hear something not right. You know,
we've heard the man's work. I don't think either one of us are going to argue with it. So, hey, I'm going to cut another 10 feet of cable and
do it
and get my crimpers out and get all nutty with it. That's what I'm thinking. On a more sciencey and less electrical engineering questionably
department thing. That was the exact opposite of an elegant segue right there. I finally picked up my first measurement calibrated microphone. I got a UMic 1 from Mini DSP.
Nice.
So I'm going to start playing around. This is, I think the first thing I'm going to use is to test a small subwoofer I have in here to see if I can figure out what particular hertz range its one notiness is. If you've never heard of subwoofer that's one notey, a lot of ported subwoofers at the lower end of the spectrum, you know, it'll be like, you know, 10 hertz, bah, 20 hertz, bah, 30 hertz, bah, 40 hertz, wah!
We found the resonance.
50 hertz. You know what I mean? Where like one particular frequency range just is feels like somebody keeps stomping on the go pedal, the volume, the turbo, is considerably louder. That is the one note of one notiness. And so this will be fun. I'm sure this will also open an incredible hell broth of experimentation.
It's really nice to be able to run test tones through a speaker, just even for basic positioning, for where you're seated. It's just nice. You can earball a lot of it, but it's convenient. And it's a quick verification, too, for the performance that you expect out of it. If there's something wrong, it's really easy to see it in a graph or you know, to make adjustments accordingly. So.
Or hopefully have something more accurate than my, you know, $30...
This being USB-driven, too, that's convenient as heck, because then you don't have to worry about, you know, a separate amp or dealing with those levels, too. And you got digital input right into your notebook or whatever. So, well, it's got its own DSP built into it, I imagine. Or
it's a fun experiment. I'm sure it's going to raise more questions than it answers. But part of the reason I picked it up is you get a discount on it. I bought a Mini DSP 2x4 kit, which essentially takes two analog channels of audio and then splits it and does digital signal processing on it. And in this case, I'm actually going to use it to create a subwoofer output, right? Because I have a subwoofer I want to play around with that does not have any built-in crossover for it. So it needs or requires a RCA jack input with the low-end signal.
Gotcha.
So I'm going to take the little Mini DSP, plug one of their basically put a plug-in in the application, and that will, you know, I can play around with where I am dropping all of the audio away from the speakers and sending it to the subwoofer. So
I like that.
Yeah, well,
it's cool.
You know, I've always traditionally completely despised digital signal processing, but it's gotten a lot better in the last couple of years, especially listening to the stuff that Sonos and other manufacturers have done. And I saw the Mini DSP for the first time on a set of LX Mini speakers from Linkwitz Lab.
Oh.
And I figure if, you know, if a guy who's trying to make state-of-the-art, you know, speakers has no issues with a DSP and can't get anybody to A-B the difference between a wired crossover or a physical, you know, collection of capacitors and coils and whatever crossover and the Mini DSP, it's probably going to be good enough for me. So
I hear you.
Mini DSP does some interesting stuff, including Dirac room correction.
Oh.
We will let you know what we learn in the future.
Very neat.
John Livings writes into ask@avxl.com. I've been trying to figure out a way to integrate Tidal into my home theater setup without buying new hardware just yet. I currently have a Pioneer VSX 1123K hooked up to a Klipsch speaker system. I'd like to get Tidal working on the current system first, then decide if I want to upgrade or purchase new hardware. What would be the best way to get high-res Tidal streaming to my system without losing quality? My phone? A PC? The receiver does have USB input for iPods and hard drives. Would this be a good option for a piece of hardware? That is a fantastic question.
Yeah. Looking to do this, it looks like a low-cost experiment to see if you can get this running and it's something you want to use. And that's probably a good way to do it, especially before you, you know, decide to throw down on a new amplifier or more gear. So
it's, you know, it's this particular Pioneer AV receiver. It's got Spotify or Spotify Connect built into it. It is, oddly enough, Windows 8 certified, which means you should be able to stream to it because it's a networked AV receiver.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's got like Pandora, HTC Connect built into it. My first thought would be to figure out there's firmware updates for the VSX 1123K. So if you go to pioneerelectronics.com and, you know, there's a firmware from actually not that long ago, December 7th, 2016, that is an update for Pandora subscribers. but they have AV Navigator for Macintosh users. But the idea is that you should be able to stream or use Windows 8 or Windows 10's Play 2 feature to stream media to the receiver. So my first thought would be to see if you can actually stream from a laptop to
running the Tidal app.
Yeah.
That would be ideal.
It is AirPlay compatible. So the receiver, that would be my first thought, would be like load Tidal on your phone and see if you can AirPlay stream to it.
That would be probably the easiest. And then now that you mention it, every time I pop open my network at home and look at the devices connected, I believe I see my network connected AVR as well. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I've ever actually tried to directly stream something to it that way.
Right.
I have a Yamaha receiver at home, but this case, that is definitely another way to try it.
Yeah. DLNA 1.5 is media streaming is supported on this Pioneer AV receiver. I would start with that. Yeah, so there's Pioneer's iControl AV 2013 that's available for Apple and Android devices, and that'll work as a remote control for the VSX 1123K. And then it should allow you to push your audio wirelessly to the receiver. This is probably not going to be the highest audio quality you can get. It depends on the quality of the DAC inside of the Pioneer, which is probably pretty good. It's amazing.
But I think it would give you a couple ways there to try out the service.
Yeah.
And see if it is something you want to further integrate into the system down the road, or for that next AVR purchase, make sure it's built in if that's critical to you.
I haven't tried streaming Tidal to Volumio, because it's amazing because you can put there's an application called Volumio that you can drop onto a Raspberry Pi. It's open source. It's basically a dedicated distro, and you can use it. I would connect an AudioQuest Dragonfly to it, and then you can use the output from the Dragonfly or whatever DAC you choose to stream to an auxiliary input on the receiver.
Totally. I was wondering if you could use a Raspberry Pi's HDMI out.
You could.
Yeah.
Actually, that would probably be smarter.
But then you would be using the integrated DAC in the Raspberry Pi, as far as I know. Unless it could. That's something to look into anyway, because that'd be super convenient, especially as your AVR.
Well, I have a sack of parts to build a new Volumio box in my bag.
Well, now.
Well, I'm a wild man.
In the bag.
The other one that's pretty impressive, might be a little more expensive than we want to look into, is runelabs.com. Rune Audio, which is a dedicated player. It will cost you, they charge money because the programmers that build Rune want to make a living, and I can respect that. It's a lifetime membership for $500. It's $120 a year. You can start with a free trial, and you can convert to a lifetime version later on. But they've kind of built this network of high-end audio manufacturers.
I was going to say too, if you have a notebook that's not in use and it has HDMI out as well, that'd be just another, a quick way to add a PC to your AVR. Yeah. So something, everyone seems to have a spare notebook. The old one that's now neglected, but still perfectly functional.
Well, it's amazing. Hopefully. I mean, it's been amazing to me as I started, nosing around sort of the high-end corners at a couple of trade shows. And then I had no idea until I was talking to one of the guys at ELAC, and they sent me one of their Discovery Series DS-S101G music servers. And I was looking at this, and I'm like, wow, it's got multiple outputs. It's got an onboard DAC. You can do digital or analog streaming off of it. You can stream to it. It comes with a lifetime subscription to Rune sort of simple. Milder version of Rune that comes bundled with this, so you're not paying $500 for Rune Audio.
Okay.
But and I was looking at this and I was like, this thing's like $1,000. This is crazy. And then you start to realize A, how good the interface is, and B, the fact that it allows you to compete or basically, output to multiple devices. And but what's really crazy is when you start to realize how many digital sources there are in the audiophile community, which brings us back to bi-wiring and spending a lot of money, where it is $3,000 to $5,000, where essentially it does the same thing as my Volumio, you know, free Volumio software running on my $35 Raspberry Pi with my $100 DAC. You know, the difference being, of course, is like this, the Discovery Music Server, you know, it's got an, you know, it's, it'll handle, you know, thousands and thousands of, like, up to 30,000 files. It'll combine personal and title contents. You know, you run it off the Rune Essentials app. You know, it's got two analog outputs, a coaxial output, an optical output. You know, you can run Ethernet to it. You have to run Ethernet to it. They don't want you screwing around with a wireless connection. So, you know, but I one part of me was like, this thing's expensive. And then I realized this thing is a third to a fifth less than the market it's targeting.
I'm also thinking too, that sounds ideal for anyone who has a large collection of content they've amassed, mm-hmm. either through ripping their own audio CDs or whatever. That's your lossless collection, and it's nice to have a device that can also take advantage of that as well. That was something that really impressed me about the Sonos app, was its ability to integrate with things like that. Although, as a separate standalone product, that's another way you could go. I want to say they have title support on there now too, but that would be a few hundred dollars to go that route with a compatible product.
I'd probably start with my phone or my computer and see if I could do the streaming directly to the AV receiver. Lot of options. AirPlay, HTC Connect, Pandora music streaming, DLNA 1.5 media streaming. Windows 8 certified Play 2. There's a ton of ways to skin this particular cat. So start with the free ones.
Yes.
Call me old fashioned.
I like it.
Oh, my goodness. Kyle E. Johnson tweets, sense of the roadmap for motherboards with HDMI 2.x support when using Kaby Lake. Only found one so far. So I haven't gotten too deep into this. Kaby Lake supports HDMI 2.0. The vast majority of vendors out there are not supporting HDMI 2.0. I've seen at least one Asus and a couple of ASRock motherboards with HDMI 2.0.
There are a lot of graphics cards out there that have HDMI 2.0 now. Or HDMI 2.0. However, it's the security bits if you plan on doing secure playback of ultra-high def Blu-ray. Mm-hmm. That's currently only available in the Kaby Lake processors, Intel. You have to run it off that GPU, not your separate graphics
Which
card.
Which brings us back to the motherboard.
So,
it's really frustrating. This is also a chicken or the egg situation. Because I recently saw.
I'll admit though, I connect my TV to my 4K display just for some games and things like that, and it's just such a massive, you know, definitely a more immersive viewing experience. So I understand that desire, but I'm not driving HDR content from my PC to it,
right?
So, well, trying to do UHD Blu-ray playback or something.
You know, it's probably been a year now. I haven't found on the Steam's website the gaming manufacturer, but you know, I want to say maybe it's the July 2016 hardware survey, but as early as the July 2015 Steam hardware survey.
Oh, the latest one that just came out highlighted that most people are still using 1080p monitors.
Yeah. The vast majority. And it's part of what makes it February 2017 Steve hardware and software.
And I use that ridiculous 16x10 size displays that are even more of a rarity nowadays. I think it's 1920x1200 on two of the monitors I use. I actually like that additional bit of height. I do.
But bringing it back to that Steam hardware and software survey, you know, as recently as July of 2015, you know, 35% of Steam's users were running at 1080p. You know, and the next highest was like 1366x768.
Oh, here we go. The hardware survey for February 2017.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the resolutions in that one. But it's kind of staggering to realize how few machines are running at higher than 1080p at this point.
Here we go.
There's the video one.
Primary display resolution, 1920 by 1080. Up 4.3% to 43%
okay.
of current users.
And then
on the
how
Steam
many
platform.
Are running at 4K?
Let us see. Multi-monitor. The multi-monitor folks are running 4K-ish resolutions. That's actually up almost a full percentage point.
To?
32.3%.
Oh.
So, and that'd be something like, say, a triple-headed display, or a dual, like dual displays spanning a system, or even the new
ultra-wide. Okay, you're looking at February
2017?
Yeah. I'm seeing as primary display resolution, 1366 by 768 is 24%.
Wait, what year is this?
1920 by 1080 is 43%.
Are you in the 2017?
Yeah, February 2017, click line item, see more detail, and yeah. everything above 1920 by 1080.
Store.steampower.com/HW
primarily display. I think you're looking at the multi-monitor desktop resolutions.
Oh, let's see here. Oh, Windows, Mac, and Linux. Let's just do Windows only.
Dun, 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 dun. I like Wicked Smart.
Yep. I'm still seeing 1920 by 1080 at 44%. That's strange.
Well, I think you're anyway. Looking at all. See, 34 by 1080 is 32% of multi-monitor desktop resolutions. And it's not even listed in the primary display resolution.
So I'm looking through Windows only, combined. Anyway. We'll come back to that.
I feel like I got to call somebody.
Yeah, let's see here. Oh, here's all of the primary resolutions. Okay. So let's take, 1920 by 1080 is like 43%. The next closest one is 1366 by 768 at 24%. Yeah. And then everything above that, the only one that breaks 1% are the 2560 by 1440 monitors.
Yeah,
so.
And that's 1.81%. Our point being is that there's not a huge amount of motivation for motherboard vendors to deal with HDMI 2.0 and HDCP when almost nobody seems to actually have a 4K monitor. Now you're thinking about a home theater PC in a living room, but you know there's so little 4K activity. I think you're going to find a small select group of high-end motherboards that haven't implemented.
I don't know if it's really a motherboard issue, though, per se. I mean, it's more about, oh, to see if it has an HDMI 2.0 port on
yes.
it. Yes. Okay.
When we're in a world that every motherboard manufacturer drops like 34 motherboards based on a new chipset, so they have every possible market segment covered from like industrial grade, we change the computer lineup every 3 years, to bleeding edge. You know, I really need multiple 3.1 USB ports.
Yes.
Or multiple USB 3.1 ports. I'm pretty sure it's just going to be, you're going to have to just deal with finding the one motherboard that'll actually do what you want it to do.
But
or,
I'll go back and say, though, what is it that you would need specifically HDMI 2.0 for? And it's very little right. of anything. Because I have a notebook right now that has an HDMI 1.4 port, mm-hmm. and it does 4K output, no problem. To a 4K TV, and it's compatible. And if I play with the TV settings, I can do 444 color output if I need to. Just mm-hmm. like having a PC connected. It's only if you're going to be doing protected playback or you're trying
that
to.
That means any Blu-ray though.
No,
or anything
no.
It's HDCP protected or just the
HDMI 2.0 would uh-huh. be for the UHD Blu-ray playback specifically, or some connected device that required it. And I can't even think of one off the top of my head. So.
There you have it. Something you might consider is a DisplayPort 1.2 to HDMI 2.0 adapter. If you have a, if you find a motherboard that is compelling that has DisplayPort 1.2, the Club 3D DisplayPort 1.2 to HDMI 2.0 UHD, which is essentially a dongle.
I use those all the time.
Costs a whopping $28.99 off of Amazon. And
that
it's
one's
completely
a little,
compatible to HDMI 2.0.
It's a little pricey compared to ones that aren't HDMI 2.0 compatible, but if you have a DisplayPort, just keep in mind that you can convert that with sound into an right. HDMI port. And the newer display ports will basically can be adapted to any of the flavors of HDMI. So digital conversion, you're not losing anything. It should introduce no lag. Nah, it's just, it's literally just making the wires compatible, making the plug bits work. And now I don't believe, and there's a technical reason for this, I don't believe you can do HDMI back to display port because of the way that, that how both systems work, unless you had some specialized piece of hardware, which most folks won't. So just keep that in mind. If you're if you have HDMI out on your computer and you're trying to convert that to use with DisplayPort on a monitor, that probably won't work, at least without special weird gear, so to speak.
We need the special weird gear.
But I love DisplayPort. I wish every TV had it.
I would go so far as to say at this point you kind of hate HDMI.
I can't say I hate it. It's everywhere, at least. At least it's consistent. That's shaped, and it's everywhere. It's digital. There's a lot of benefit to it.
So is the Norwegian rats, except for the benefit part.
I love that the DisplayPort cables generally are also pinned in. Not pinned in, but they lock in. And you actually have to squeeze them to unlock them.
Until you're bent into a pretzel behind a desk trying to pull out a DisplayPort monitor and can't.
Oh! You get the finger cramps.
I need a forceps. We need the forceps.
Exactly. That's a good idea.
I always have forceps nearby. At Scotty Tech tweets, I need to update my 2007 Toshiba 1080p 40-inch HD TV to something way better and affordable. Best under $1,000. Go.
Hisense, TCL. Those are two of the great low-cost options, especially if you're in that under $1,000 budget. Mm-hmm. You can get good-sized screens, features and performance that are solid. Most are 4K now. Whether or not they'll be HDR and wide color gamut compatible, but whether or not they actually can effectively do that compared to some of the more premium TVs, probably not as well. But they're going to look fantastic. I really like the TCL. I picked up my mom. It has built-in Roku. That's just one of the nicest interfaces I've ever used. And it's super customizable, too, for folks. So you can always have it come back to the exact same thing it left off on. Or it just for simplification and the integration of having that Roku built-in was really nice. I will say I just found a 65-inch Hisense 4K smart TV. 65 inches. You think going from a 40-inch screen to a 65-inch screen. And this thing is currently listing on Amazon for $650 for a 65-inch screen, and that to me is just like
crazy.
I'm not
thinking of that as like I need a fantastic reference grade monitor for HDR Ultra Blu-rays.
It's gonna look good,
but that's gonna be a fantastic 1080p TV and a mediocre HDR TV,
and I bet you it does superb output with things like Blu-ray video and all your current HD sources and things like that. And you have support for 4K streaming too if you've got the bandwidth and whatnot built in. Let's see. It does have built-in apps and whatnot. 4K resolution. The model number is the 65CU6200. A lot of people seem really happy with it, especially at that price. Again, it's like $10 an inch.
Seems
diagonal measurement. There you go. That's a tough deal. I mean, I always like high performance, super contrasted, bright pictures, but these are going to get you like 80, 90% of it for a freaking bargain. It's hard to think about what else you could spend that extra savings on.
A 300-foot spool of the Choice Series 12AWG oxygen-free pure bare copper speaker wire. Oh, my goodness. We got, it's good picks. At Eric Belusic tweets, at Patrick Norton, one more triple driver or the Monopies triple X driver? Are the one mores worth double the price?
Ooh.
I love Monoprice's $16 8323 premium hi-fi DJ style over-the-ear pro headphones, which ironically turns out to have been a project that one of my favorite, somewhat more expensive headphone designers worked on early in his career. Oh, the irony.
Funny.
I bought 5 different pairs of Monoprice earbuds back in 2016 to review on Tech Thing, and I didn't like any of them. I mean, admittedly, the most expensive of them was like $20, but they were all uniformly awful, which is something you run into with inexpensive earbuds. There's just not a lot of space to work with in an earbud or an ear monitor design. So I will see if I can pry a set of these $50 Triple X drivers out of Monoprice. See what happens.
I've been super satisfied with the $99 triple drivers from One More.
Yeah. Which ironically are available on Costco for like $80, and I've seen them on sale at Amazon for $80. That is my standard. That is my go-to. That is my favorite deal in earbuds. Also got to review on Tech Thing last week, Vmoto's Forza and One More's Quad Driver, which we talked about back at CES 2017.
Oh, yeah.
Really impressive low end on the quad driver.
Nice.
Not inexpensive, $200. Big jump up from the One More triple driver, literally twice the cost. But I keep thinking of the quad driver as being a lot like adding a subwoofer to a really nice pair of bookshelf speakers. All of a sudden, the low end is there. Not in a horrible in-your-face,
right,
like somebody take the 15-year-old and get him away from the equalizer, you know, or somebody turn the... When you get in the rental car and the bass is set to 100 and the treble is set to nothing.
They need like a store mode for those rental cars where it just resets itself after a day or something.
And it makes the display really bright so you can't drive at night. One More is Quad Driver. They have, if you've been looking for really good music with a much more low end than they're used to, that's a really good option. I was listening to Preservation Hall Jazz Band's That's It, and that first track on that, which is these big fat kind of tubas laying down a bass line, it was like, whoa, I feel like I'm on the stage with the tubas.
Nice.
You know, but not in a bad way.
That's a smile-inducing moment.
It is, but it's $200, you know, so I don't know if that's for, you know, unless you're really into bass, I don't know if it's worth twice the cost of the triple drivers. Vmoto, fantastic manufacturer of headphones. They believe in really, really good audio. They believe in style. They believe that DJs should be able to beat down groupies away from the turntables with their headphones without damaging the headphones. I can't speak for the groupies. And that's my interpretation of their build quality. They build really sturdy stuff. Gotcha. Forza is an in-ear monitor. They've got some optional like $20 3D printed design so you can make it particularly fashion forward. But they are like exercise ready, sweat proof. You know, go take them on a bicycle range, bicycle ride, go take them to the gym. Mil-spec. For okay. Whatever that's worth, kind of rated. The idea is like they built a pair of, you know, in-ear monitors that you can get your stank on with without destroying them. I would probably not take my triple drivers into the rain. I probably don't want to be sweating profusely into my triple drivers at the gym. But those Forzas are all about the sweat and the rain and the mayhem. And I think they sound a lot better than most of the sport-oriented earbuds I've heard. They cost about $100, so a thumbs up for both of those.
Excellent.
And if I can get Eric Belusic, if I can get Monoprice to spring for a pair of loaners on that Triple X driver, I will let you know how they compare to the One More. One More is tough to beat. Tough to beat. Well, just not a lot to say about Blu-rays this week. I will say Wolf Children, Funimation reissued Wolf Children. Girl meets wolf fan, falls in love, has two kids, and stuff happens. That's the summary of that.
I finally did get my pre-order in, though, for Planet Earth 2 on Ultra High Def Blu-ray.
We're both on that.
I just dropped the $50. So I'm anticipating glorious vistas and...
and animals.
And Mr. Attenborough's sweet, sweet tones.
Breeding and killing each other.
But
life. Wolf Children anime. Some people compare the anime style to Studio Ghibli, which would be Totoro if you're not familiar with that name. Really incredibly well reviewed by critics, and hopefully it's the same excellent transfer that Funimation released back in 2013. Have you seen the new Game of Thrones trailer on HBO?
I have not.
Dig into HBO now.
Okay.
It's there.
Okay.
What? Answers no questions, opens so many possibilities. My wife is vibrating with her desperate need to find out what happens because she's read the books Yeah, because she would read the books while she was nursing our youngest, or reread the books. So at this point, I think she's read the entire series of books like three times.
And now you're beyond the books, right?
And now, yeah. And now HBO's, you know, beyond the books. So we're going to find out what happens beyond the books.
That's awesome. I've been getting my spring training on for the baseball season that's starting up.
MLB.TV.
Yeah, checking it out. They're doing their 60 frame per second, 720p-ish video streaming service. I really like it. If you're a baseball fan, it's not a bad deal. Apparently they still have the blackout restrictions and other stuff too, which can be annoying to say the least. That should all just go away. I will say though, they've updated some of the graphics, and the one thing I'm a little irked about, and they're not the only company doing this, Comcast Sportsnet, they use static graphics on the screen, and in the case of MLB TV, during the commercial breaks, there's a static MLB logo on the screen with a very hard white outline, and I just keep cringing at what my plasma display would be doing, cycling that, you know,
right,
frequently, and it's just not something I like to see. I hate seeing hard white lines, just because I know that they can trigger burn-in on a lot of these plasma screens that are still out there, and it makes it. I'm less inclined to watch sporting events on a plasma screen than I would be, say, an LCD or an OLED.
Really?
Just for that reason. Because the damn tickers and anything that's just not moving, if it sits there long enough and you're watching that regularly, you will see an after image that will be harder and harder to get rid of without proper treatment.
So the trick is just watch more movies and fewer sports.
I simply would like them to use transparent graphics a little more or move the damn thing constantly. And there shouldn't be this kind of static, hard, white stuff on screens. But I'm glad these OLEDs are at least as robust as they claim to be, because I'm not hearing any major issues there. But I still have a score ticker, a Comcast score ticker, still on my plasma display that's in storage right now. And I think about that a lot. And my quest against hard graphics on the screen, hard white graphics anyway.
Oh, man.
That don't move. Static.
How many hours of baseball watching did it take to generate that?
Less than a season.
Really?
Of just one team, pretty much, because I can see the team name burned into the screen.
160 games times an average of...
It's, you know, it's also, it's like my radio, so it's like the background noise in the office. So it's just always...
I'm trying to tease you, but it's not working.
No, it's horrible.
Yeah. Well, it took like, what, 800 hours to burn that in?
Maybe. Well, I guess at least. I could. You know, I should go in the service menu and see how many hours I have that team.
I want to know how many hours the average MLB game plays now.
They were trying very hard to keep them moving along and shortening them up to some success. So,
where's the fun in that?
Yeah, exactly.
Next thing you're going to tell me is small ball and keep it in the infield.
I do like baseball, though.
Baseball is good for the soul. Yes. It'd be nice for the A's to go all the way this year.
That I'm not going to put any money on that. I will enjoy the ride, but I'm not expecting the way that team operates.
We have to take the boys to
it's very profitable.
The A's this year.
Heck yeah. Ride the train right out there.
Hot dogs. I'm like, we'll ride our bikes there. We're like a mile and a half from the stadium.
Even better.
With that, ladies and gentlemen, once the AV Excel conversation has devolved to baseball, we know it's safe to tell you about AV Excel, actually patreon.com/AVExcel, which is...
Heck yeah.
How we pay for this, how we pay for the bandwidth, how we pay for our time. We want to bring you video, but we got to get up to $1,000 a month at patreon.com/AVExcel to make it happen. They won't be pretty videos because we are not pretty men. And we're looking to keep it simple because we want to focus on the content and not the production values. Unless you start raining money on us and tell us that production value is a condition of that, we won't fight you. There's a lot of you, a lot
Make
more of you
rain.
Than there are us. But yeah, it's a terrible, terrible image.
It is.
We want to thank each and every one of you for listening. And to remind you that avxl.com is the place to find all of our older episodes and information on subscribing. HeronFidelity.com is where you can find Robert's picks, television reviews, and all of his analysis of the latest news in HD home theater and other mayhem. And you can normally find me at TechThing.com.
You can always find us on Twitter, too.
Yeah.
At Patrick Norton.
At Robert Aaron. At Robert Aaron. And
at AVXL.
Hey, do us a favor. Email your questions. Ask at AVXL because we like answering them. And no question too crazed.
No
question too small.
And our Google Play is running now, and it seems to be picking up our feeds properly. Good. So I'm going to push another episode to that as well, out to the public.
Next up, audio on YouTube.
I'm getting good at least getting the episodes out to the Patreon supporters, like, next day. Good. Last handful of episodes have all been next day. So now I'll just get the public release a little prompter.
We'll make
now that we got the I'm glad we're on Google Play, though. A lot of people were asking for that.
Google Play it is. Ladies and gentlemen, with that bright and cheerful thought, I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I'm Robert Herron.
We'll see you next week on AV Excel.